Premier Christian Newscast.
It's not just the Church of England and the Catholic Church which has been wrestling with divisions over same-sex marriage in recent years. The Baptist Union is also split between those who believe God affirms gay marriage and those who hold to the traditional opposition to it. Yet, unlike other denominations, the Baptists have come recently to an interesting compromise. Individual congregations are at liberty to host same-sex weddings or not, according to their consciences. But gay Baptist ministers will not be allowed to themselves enter same-sex marriages. But can this settlement hold? I'm Tim Wyatt, and you're listening to the Premier Christian Newscast. This week, we're considering the British Baptist Church's handling of the sexuality debate. How has the distinctive Baptist ecclesiology led them to this unusual position? What might we learn about where Baptists are at today thanks to their extensive consultation? What are the forces pulling Baptists either towards the affirming or traditionalist ends of the debate? And can this halfway house they have landed on really last? Today we'll be joined by three Baptist ministers, one affirming, one traditionalist, and one who's also a journalist, to unpick what their church has decided and what it means for the future. Well, brilliant to have you all on the show today. Thanks for joining us. Before we kick off, could I just ask each of you to briefly introduce yourselves and say a little bit about what you do? Ashley, why don't you go first?
Great. Hello, Tim. My name's Ashley Hardingham. I'm a Baptist minister. I have been, this is my 30th year consecutive as a Baptist minister.
Congratulations.
if that's a thing. And I'm currently in South Manchester, and I've been in the church here for 13 years.
Brilliant. Chris, who are you?
Yeah, I'm Chris Goswami. Hi. I'm an associate minister at a church very close to Ashley's church. So I'm at Lynn Baptist Church. Haven't been there as long as Ashley's been longer being a minister, though. And I also write and blog on my blog, 7minutes.net.
And last but not least, Mark.
Yeah, I can beat Ashley, I think, in terms of length of service. I'm over 30 years now. I'm a Baptist minister, and now I work in writing and communications.
Brilliant. And interestingly, for our purposes, formerly editor of the Baptist Times newspaper as well.
Absolutely.
Speaking of, could I come to you first then, Mark? This whole conversation has kind of been instigated by recent decision that the Baptist Union Council did, which was voted that Baptist ministers should not be permitted to enter same-sex marriages. Could you explain a little bit about how that decision was made and what the process has been leading up to it?
Sure, yeah. It started in 2020 when 70 Baptist members, ministers, wrote to the Baptist Union Council asking for a change to the current ministerial recognition rules. At the moment, the rules refer to sexual misconduct, which brings the church and ministry into disrepute. And there is an NB at the end of that. This specifically includes sexual intercourse and other genital sexual activity outside of marriage, and then brackets, as defined exclusively as between a man and a woman. And the 70 members who wrote to the council requested that the section in brackets was removed, which would mean that a minister who is in a same-sex marriage would no longer be committing gross misconduct and therefore would no longer lose their accreditation as a Baptist minister. So the Ministerial Recognition Committee referred this to the Baptist Union Council. The council considered it in 2022 and felt that they needed to go out to wider consultation. This process of consultation with Baptist churches, ministers, colleges was extended to autumn 2023, and the council voted in March 2024 against this request. So the section in brackets would not be removed, and a minister in a same-sex marriage would lose their accreditation.
And where do the Baptists as a denomination stand on gay marriage in general? Is it possible for gay couples who are not ministers to get married in a Baptist church, for instance?
It's possible for some churches, yes, have registered for same-sex marriage, and the denomination has said that that's up to them. They can't stop them from doing that. So yes, in theory it is possible, but I think somewhere between 25 and 30 Baptist churches have registered for that, but it's not very common, certainly.
And Ashley and Chris, you both wrote interesting pieces for Premier Christianity, exploring your own kind of responses to the decision by the Union Council. Would you mind kind of briefly summarising for us how you felt about the decision that was come to? Ashley, can I come to you first?
Sure, yeah. So I was one of the 70 signatories all that time ago. And also we were part of the consultation as a church. And also you could respond both individually as a minister, the consultation, and as a church. So we sent two responses in. And I guess, in short, I wasn't at all surprised by the outcome from what I understand of where the Baptist Church is up to in this country. But that isn't to say that I wasn't disappointed by the outcome. I wish it had been otherwise.
And Chris, what about you? Were you involved in the consultation?
Well, I responded to the consultation as a minister, so I was not one of the signatories. And my position is I support the church's historic definition of marriage, the church's ideal as being between one man and one woman. So, yeah, I mean, I wasn't surprised either, probably relieved, actually, that they came up with that conclusion to leave the wording of marriage as it is between one man and one woman. I mean, so the article that you referred to that me and Ashley wrote together, you know, I think we should say was very much along, you know, our motivation wasn't to pitch both sides of the battle, but it was actually to get out of the trenches and say, you know what, it's possible to have a sensible, civilized, friendly, loving discussion from both sides of this debate, and to do that well and to disagree well. And I hope we did that in our article, because that was certainly our motivation. That sadly, this has become, you know, a real point of division for so many denominations, for so many churches, and we don't want that to happen.
Just to say, Chris asked me as a friend at a conference we were both at, just kind of in passing as we were leaving, and I was very happy to respond. When you've got an established relationship with somebody, these things can happen a lot more easily. So yeah, Chris was able to write some stuff and I was invited to write a response to that.
And as someone on the kind of, you know, labels are difficult here, but let's say the affirming theological position within the Baptists, how do you feel the conversation during this consultation and the wider debate has gone? Has it been conducted in kind of good faith? Has it been civil? Has it been respectful? Has it been fractious?
I mean, I can only speak from what I observe, and I observe a very small fraction of that. So just on some other different levels, I'm not on the Baptist Union Council, who were the kind of overseeing body who finally vote on that. So I wasn't part of those conversations, but I've not heard from those that do, not that I've sought it out, but that was fractious at all. So I'm pleased about that. I think they have been more fractious in the past. There were certainly some guidelines that were kind of set out. So, hey, it's a bit niche, but there is a Baptist minister's Facebook page. And, you know, we were asked not to air the issue, particularly on that website, which is completely right and appropriate to do that at that time. Interestingly, one kind of subset of Baptistness is an organisation called Fresh Dreams, previously called Mainstream. And they were kind of set up perhaps 40 plus years ago as a kind of expression of Baptist charismatic renewal. That's where they came from. So the Word and Spirit kind of network. And very interestingly, over the last year or so, on the back of a summer theology school they ran in summer 2022 on this issue, they actually visited, I think, 3/4 of the regional associations. So that's like the diocese, if you have it, of Baptists. and facilitated a conversation amongst the ministers in those contexts. I was at the theology school. I found that to be a very equitable conversation where both sides were able to express their views fully. I went to my region association, Fresh Dreams Day, and again, I would say that was expressed in a really good spirit. And having been through the conversation in my own church about LGBT plus inclusion through 22 and into 23, as a church, in a sense, we were pretty well placed to kind of revisit this and just probably affirm our conclusions that we made back over a year ago.
I think the, you know, just to add to that, I think the process, I also have not been in the centre of the process, but as a participant and observer, has been done incredibly well. I mean, I think the consultation was thorough, had many, many opportunities for dialogue and reflection, was done by an independent set of consultants. And throughout, as you'll see the message from our General Secretary, Lynn Green, after the process completed, you know, she's very focused, and I hope we're very focused on looking after one another, that this is a theological issue and an issue of ecclesiology, etc. But it actually is also about real people who are really hurt. And I think her lead to look after one another has been taken well. I hope it's been taken well. And I think, as I say, I think the process has been done very well.
Mark, I saw you nodding your head. How do you think it's? Would you agree it's been handled well, particularly in comparison to some other churches that have really fallen out over this issue?
I do think it's been handled well, actually. I have been observing the process, really, rather than taking an active part in it. And I have not picked up. I mean, there have been a few individuals, certainly in one or two of the Facebook groups that I belong to, who have felt very passionately on one side or another, and feelings tend to get high, and things are sometimes written which, you know, probably shouldn't have been written. But I think that's a minority, actually, and I think most people have been able to say, well, look, there are strong arguments on both sides, and we just need to listen to each other and respect each other, and the decision is what the decision is. And as far as I can tell, most people have accepted that this is where the denomination is. So yes, answer to your question, I think it's been done well. I think one of the interesting things for me is the Baptist ecclesiology and the way that Baptists exist as a union. So we're not like the Methodists, because the Methodist Conference makes a decision, and that is binding on all Methodist churches, all Methodist chapels, local congregations. It's just not like that with us at all, because each Baptist church is an independent church, and the model is more of a federation than a church with a capital C. And that has made a big difference, I think, to this whole process.
But having said all that, and, you know, we all think it was a great process. Mm. I was just looking at some of the stats again this morning, and I saw that something like one quarter of ministers and over a third of churches said they could not stay in a covenant relationship with people who hold the opposite view. So a significant number of ministers and churches saying or talking about leaving the union if the rules changed. And so that, I think, was disappointing, you know, because I would hope that part of the point of being a Baptist is we respect and defend everybody's individual right to believe the autonomy of the local church to make its own decision. So to then say, you know, we will leave the BU if it doesn't go our way, is very un-Baptist, is very un-Christian. So there was, you know, a disappointing number of responses and comments in that direction, I think.
It just might be worth picking up on this. Tim, your knowledge, just explain a bit more. Mark's done really well to say something about the ecclesiology. But one of the implications of that is that Baptists do not have a statement of faith, for example. We have this thing called a declaration of principle, which is very short. and has been pressure tested, to my knowledge, significantly, probably three times over its history, back to, you know, 1870s and Spurgeon and all of that. And what's it's come through the fire of the testing, and our association, our unity, is based on our relationship. It's not based on a statement of faith as such.
Yeah.
And therefore, we pledge to be in community with other Baptist churches and respect the right of other Baptist churches to have liberty in their practice and their views. So, for example, many Baptist church will sign up to an Evangelical Alliance, say, statement of faith, and there are others who won't, out of principle, sign up to that. So that's a significant difference.
That's helpful. I mean, that kind of comes, one of the things I find most fascinating looking on the outside is, as you say, this idea that actually individual Baptist churches have a lot of liberty to follow their conscience and follow their convictions. And you've seen that over the kind of settlement that the you know, you are permitted or you cannot be prevented from registering to consecrate to hold same-sex marriages, same-sex weddings, if you wish. So I was kind of interested that that doesn't extend to the rights of ministers to follow their conscience around whether they enter into a same-sex marriage. Have I misunderstood? Is that different issues? Is that a conflict? Is that a contrast?
No, that is right. The stats are interesting in this respect because I think that only 8% of respondents as churches said that they would be happy to support the shift in understanding. But 25% of ministers would be up for supporting that. So there's a clear difference between where overall ministers are versus churches. And then to add another twist to this, I was intrigued by the breakdown. They gave the breakdown by ethnicity, by social deprivation, by gender. Mm-hmm. So again, on the gender one, about half of all women Baptist ministers would support the shift. So there's some quite interesting subplots going on in the whole big story.
I think that's interesting, actually. The other interesting one that caught my eye was that the breakdown by age, and that actually, and I thought surprisingly, and I said, I forgive me if I've got this slightly wrong, but something like Baptist churches where the average age is 40 or below turn out to be more conservative, want to stick to the traditional understanding of marriage, compared with churches who are average age is 60 or above, who are more in favour of changing the rules and relaxing the rules, which I thought was interesting because kind of, you know, you tend to think, oh, you know, younger people growing up, they all kind of know, have friends who are same-sex, etc., and are less conservative, but that wasn't the case. I mean, I don't know what you think of that, Mark or Ashley.
Well, that is interesting, and I do have the figures in front of me, actually. It's 76% of churches with an average of age of less than 40 say no to ministers in same-sex marriages. It's 53% right. of churches with an average age of over 60 say no. So in both cases, it's a majority against. But it, as you say, Chris, it's very significantly weighted towards those who are younger. So
what's your understanding of that?
Well, there are strong conservative influences on younger people for various reasons, and it's not just the churches that they attend. It's also the kind of stuff that they're consuming online. You know, if you go to conservative American websites for some of your biblical teaching, then they're very clear on this issue. So I'm just wondering, and I have no evidence one way or the other, but I'm just wondering if there is something in the Christian cultural atmosphere which might steer them in that direction.
I'd agree, Mark. I think there are those influences. So whereas my understanding is that, in a sense, standalone younger people seem to have a predominantly inclusive, affirming view, the kind of churches which are younger, young adult churches, I think still retain a very clearly conservative agenda with them. And the other thing that I just probably pick up on as well is that I think that, in a sense, in the isolation of being a single young person who is asked their view on this matter, they may have a very affirming view. I think there's a shift that when those people get married and start having children, actually they revert to a kind of very traditional image of how that should operate, and perhaps alter their views accordingly in that respect. On the women one, I asked a woman Baptist minister what she thought about this stat of half of female Baptist ministers being affirming, and she just smiled wryly and said, well, when you've been through such a battle to find your place as a minister of this church, you're going to have a greater degree of sympathy for that kind of argument, which I thought made sense to me.
Mm. I'd love to know whether you, all of you, really think this is a settlement that can kind of last for the long term. There's often a sense, when I cover this in other denominations, which is that even when, quote unquote, the conservatives kind of gain a victory, there's a sense of the tenuousness of it because there's this the onrushing march of culture and older conservatives are dying off, though, as we've heard, maybe not necessarily. Do you think this idea, that's not the case of the Baptists, that this was a settlement that could really kind of stick and hold for the next 50 plus years? Mark, you had your hand up there.
Well, it will certainly hold for the next 5 years because it can't be brought back to the council for another 5 years. So no matter what discussions go on behind the scenes, under the surface, I don't think there's going to be a relitigation of this particular issue in that time period. The other thing to say is that there is this conservative majority among younger people, so it becomes less likely that this will be revisited at a structural level over the next few years as these people grow up and as they take their place in grow older, and as they take their place in the union's structures. So I think this is something which will hold actually for a considerable period at that structural level. However, because of the nature of the Baptist polity, the Baptist ecclesiology, that's not really the end of the story. I mean, there is nothing to stop a Baptist church having a minister in a same-sex marriage. They can go one of two routes. They could leave the Baptist Union and that would not be a problem at all, or they can apply to the Baptist Union for a waiver. All it means is that you can't be accredited as a Baptist minister by the national body and be in a same-sex marriage. You can be the minister of a Baptist church and not be accredited as a Baptist minister. So if that were the case, then most churches, I think I'm right in saying this, most churches' trust deeds say that you have to apply to the union for a waiver, which will let you appoint a minister who is not an accredited minister. So that's going to be a problem for the Baptist Union to face. And I'm not aware that that bridge has been crossed yet.
I don't think it has, but I think it will. Yeah. I think in the next 5 years, we'll see that tested. There are, I say many, I don't have a number of many, but there are tens and tens of gay Baptist ministers. And I recognise the difference that Mark's just cited between what happens in the kind of structures and what happens in the local church. But I think that the shift will continue, and you know, there may be in 5 years' time, if this gets revisited, I can see further shifts in this. Partly because I recognise Mark's point and that thing about the culture of younger churches and the conservative themes within that. But I wonder about whether those churches will remain as defiantly strong and significant over the coming years. I think they're likely to be less significant in the future. And therefore, these other shifts will become more significant. And I'm not quite sure I would say it's only a matter of time, but I think the shift will be through a whole lot of mediums, through how evangelicals are looking at the scriptures, through the kind of idea that this is a credible option, because certainly Mark and others we've cited that there are viable arguments on both sides. That kind of plausibility realm of this being something which is valid within the evangelical church, I don't see that stopping. I see that continuing.
Premier Christian Newscast. Premier Christian Newscast.
I mean, I would just reflecting on a couple of things that both Mark and Ashley have said. I mean, I increasingly feel that discussions like this is probably the paramount one at the moment, often are more to do with tribalism and identity than they are with actually what the Bible says. That, you know, I was taught something when I was five in my evangelical church, and, you know, once you start questioning that, kind of my faith, almost like a house of cards, starts to come down. And that, unfortunately, I see that tribalism and identity politics, identity faith, increasing in society, in the US elections for sure, and nationalism here in Europe, in the UK, and also in the church. There's an increasing sense that we need to identify with strongly to give us a sense of purpose, a sense of worth, a sense of almost, defending against something. And that's good in some ways, good to belong, but I think it's negative as well. I mean, Ashley, some years ago when I came to ministry relatively late, and Ashley mentored me for a couple of years. I remember, Ashley, you saying once, I don't know if you made this up or if you heard somebody else say it, but I remember you saying, Chris, 20% of your theology is wrong, and you don't know which 20%.
Actually, I was quoting Tom Wright then.
Tom Wright. Right, great. Well, good you said that, so you didn't steal it.
I just don't know which 20%.
But this is important, and I think we've got, many Christians in our churches are at the stage where, being wrong is alien. It's though our whole faith hinges on us being right 100% of the time on every possible doctrine. If we're somehow wrong on anything, the whole house of cards comes down. And I think it's important to that actually our faith is more than that, has to be more than that. And sometimes we will be wrong. And that's why I hope that what Ashley and I put together, certainly from my perspective, I think I might be wrong. I don't know. Yeah, this is what I think at the moment. This is what I believe. But I might be wrong. And I think that's okay.
That's really interesting. And Chris, I think you're absolutely right when you talk about tribalism and that being the driver of some of the disagreements, or at least the heat in some of the disagreements that we've seen. And that's true on both sides, I think, actually. And I think the other thing to say is that I read both of your articles and I thought they really modelled disagreement really well. So I thought that was impressive, actually. But I think I want to highlight something again about Baptists, which contributes to the seriousness, I suppose, and the sense that something is at stake here, and that is the Baptist reliance on the Bible as its foundation for faith and practice, in a way which I don't think is really true of some other denominations. We have the Bible, and other denominations have there's a Methodist quadrilateral, for instance, so there's the Bible and experience and tradition and reason, I think it is. The Catholic Church, the Anglican Church, both rely on tradition and episcopal authority and so on and so forth. Baptists really try to go straight to the source, and that was our origin back in originally the Continental Reformation of the 16th, 17th century.
I just throw a count in there, because our Declaration of Principles doesn't actually say that.
No, but
the Declaration of Principles says that the ultimate authority for faith is Jesus Christ.
Yes.
As revealed in the scriptures.
Yes.
So it differs from the EA statement of faith, which just goes to the Bible. And I think that small difference is actually very significant. So we Baptists claim that their ultimate determinant of faith is Jesus Christ, rather than saying the Bible.
Well, I think the Declaration of Principle claims that. And I think that's actually a rather odd thing to say, as a matter of fact, because what we know of Jesus Christ, we know from the Bible. And the other thing is that the Baptist denomination is an evangelical denomination. In other words, that largely its culture is evangelical, and many, many Baptist churches would be members of the Evangelical Alliance as well. So I'm not convinced by that, actually, to be honest. And I just get the sense that if it is felt that people in your position are in some way slighting the Bible or don't take its teaching seriously, that becomes it becomes a really fundamental issue. I mean, there is a Baptist grouping called Evangelical Baptists, which I don't know if you've come across that, and that was sort of kicked into to action, really kicked into life by this debate, and it's formed of people who do not believe in same-sex marriage. And I was looking at that website this morning, and it's quite clear that for some of the contributors to that site, this is it's really an issue of salvation. It's an issue that is quite fundamental to their faith. And
there we kind of have it. You've just said the Baptist denomination is evangelical.
Yeah.
And yet a group has to feel they have to call themselves evangelical Baptists.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting, which one is it? Where are the evangelicals in this? Mm. And I guess by claiming that name,
yes.
And we can spend another podcast or 10 discussing the merits of the emergence of the evangelical, et cetera, et cetera. But the idea that therefore evangelicalism equals a certain view on this issue of sexuality, that logic does not follow. And yet clearly they are trying to gain the ground, I guess, of evangelicalism, as in that argument. I myself would claim to be evangelical. And trying to clutch at, well, what is an evangelical? I would go back to David Bebbington's fourfold statement about what an evangelical is and take those things very seriously. But Marx identified the fact that I think for some, your evangelical identity and very much your kind of perhaps your Christian ministry is now stands and falls on this issue. This has become the issue by which those things are determined, which is a view, quite. But if we look back over 100, 150 years, I think that this is just the latest iteration of whatever the contentious issue was 20 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, whether it's women in ministry, whether it's charismatic renewal, whether it's can evangelicals share associates with Roman Catholics, whatever. These were all crunch issues. And this appears to be the crunch issue of the moment.
And I mean, I would just add on to the end of what you've both said that, so Mark, you're saying, Baptist theology stands and falls on the word. And Ashley's saying, actually, it's Jesus Christ as manifested in the word here. And I would, personally tend to go more towards Ashley's view there, that I think, Mark, you're maybe tending towards a sola scriptura kind of view, scripture alone and only scripture. I don't think that's I don't think it's coherent to say scripture alone. I think there has to be reason and rationality and, all the other things you brought into it. But maybe the Declaration of Principle was written deliberately for that purpose, so that, you can take that view, Mark, and Ashley can take that view and still be in covenantal relationship with each other.
Hmm. Yes, I should say that I wasn't expressing my own view there, Chris. I was trying to express what where I think many Baptist churches are, actually.
I think your point was good that, you know, one of the problems has been that the inclusive view has been thought to be slighting the Bible. They're not slighting the Bible, from my understanding, but that's the impression that people get. You know, you're not taking the Bible seriously, quotes and quotes, and that is a problem for lots of Baptists and Baptist churches.
And this is what I find fascinating, having followed this conversation, particularly in the Church of England most recently, where part of the crux of the kind of the logjam in the Church of England is not just that you have a liberal wing and a conservative wing who think different things about same-sex relationships, of course you do, but it's that they don't agree over what kind of disagreement they're having. And the liberals think this is a kind of agree to disagree issue. No one's going to make your church do a gay wedding against your principles or impose a gay vicar against your will. What's the issue here? Whereas large numbers of the evangelicals in particular say this is not it's not like women leadership or your take on child versus adult baptism or any other issue which Anglicans are divided. They would understand this as a definitional, existential, almost, you know, sometimes they use the language of creedal. And so it's been interesting seeing that the Baptists, who have a very different ecclesiology, I mean, on one level, find it easier to agree to disagree. But as you're saying, Mark, there are still actually that strand of evangelicalism within the Baptist church, which says, actually, this is not something that we can just put in the box alongside things like divorce or, you know, other issues of division, which no one wants to schism over.
There's one of my predecessors here at the church I'm at is a guy called Nigel Wright. He's a Baptist minister and previously principal of Spurgeon's Theological College. And Nigel has written many books, and one of the ones he produced in his retirement was interestingly called Vital Truth. If I could describe it as kind of part, it's a kind of testimonial systematic theology. So it's, these are the things that I've come to understand and believe about Christian faith. I would encourage anyone to buy the book simply for the introduction. It's a great book throughout, but the introduction. And Nigel does a very appropriate thing as an evangelical, charismatic Baptist minister. He divides our understanding of faith into three sections. He says there is dogma, doctrine, and theological understanding. The dogma, he says, is basically the creeds. This is the kind of non-negotiables of faith. If it's not that, it's not Christian. Doctrine is just one step removed from that. So we have Trinity, Atonement, other theologies, which we've been born out of our understanding of Scripture and our dogma. The rest, he says, well, that's theological opinion. One thing is bold to say, I think the more liberal you are, the more you stretch the theological opinion and squeeze your dogma and doctrine. The more conservative you are, the more you stretch the dogma and doctrine and squeeze out the theological opinion. Doesn't really matter what you think on this subject. And that, I think, comes into play in this argument. So it's where you put this issue. Does it fall under dogma? Well, it's not in the creeds. Do you put it under doctrine, perhaps discuss, or is it theological opinion? And depending on your wing, it may fall in one realm of that or the other.
I do think it's interesting to just the last thing you said there, Ashley, that, you know, when they created the creeds, as you say, the found, you know, kind of foundational, I think, to what all Christians must subscribe to. We know there was a lot of discussion around sexual ethics going on in the early church, but they did not include anything to do with sexuality in the creeds, which I think that says something by the fact that perhaps, you know, we've overstated the importance of this topic in recent years.
And I think there's something about the fact that it's such a vital, pressing concern in wider culture, which feels that it makes us feel as Christians, we have to therefore potentially see this as a pressing, urgent issue within church culture. When I look into church history, it's fascinating to discover there was a whole episode in the Anglican Church with the Anglican Communion. There were some, you know, lots of denominate parts of the communion in Africa where polygamy was a kind of long-standing practice. And there was a whole question of, you know, can we tolerate this? Are we an exclusively kind of monogamous church? And in the end, they came up with a kind of typically Anglican, kind of fudgy, messy compromise, which said, no, we believe in monogamy, but we're not going to like excommunicate people who have converted to Christianity and have more than one wives and force them to pick a wife. And it just strikes me as, you know, again, that's a disagreement about marriage. It seems kind of crazy and esoteric and not relevant, but actually throughout church history, there have been, as someone once said, these flashpoints, these crunch points. And, you know, often with the benefit of 100 years of hindsight, we look back and think, isn't it odd that people were coming to blows almost over these issues? And so I don't know how history will view our current moment, but I'd love to know in 200 years how people view what we currently feel right now as this pressing, urgent, fractious, difficult, divisive topic of same-sex marriage.
And I wonder if things are moving on so fast in society terms that almost society is past and beyond this issue. So when we as a church went through the year-long process and finally became an affirming church, on the front page of our website, there is one of these kind of generic statements about we welcome people irrespective of age, gender, ethnicity, sex, sexual orientation is down there. And then the very last statement is irrespective of political opinion. And I said to my church last Sunday in the sermon, I said, you know what? I think people walking past the building, that's the really controversial thing. You mean you can have any political opinion and come here? Wow. So I think society moves on pretty quickly on these things.
It certainly does. And it certainly feels like, as ever, the church is running about 20 to 30 years behind culture, and we are falling out over gay marriage, which I wouldn't dispute is an incredibly significant, important ethical question. But as you say, what is the conversation happening beyond the church? It's mostly moved on to the T of the LGBT at the moment. And that is what is causing a lot of heat and light and sound and fury. And that is an issue I think most denominations have really only just begun to kind of get their teeth into. What on earth do we think, do we do, do we feel about trans people, trans Christians, trans ministers, beyond the scope of this podcast? But yeah, I just think it is always interesting how the church is often struggling, or at least is taking its time. Maybe that's a good thing, taking its time over these decisions.
Well, I think it is a good thing, actually. There's that oft-quoted saying, and I can't remember who said it, but when the church marries the spirit of this age, it'll be a widow in the next. And there's a lot of truth in that, actually. And I think things in culture move very quickly, and I think it's absolutely right that the church, which has a 2,000-year-long history, should move much more slowly and much more carefully, if at all.
That's helpful, because I think we lose the long view of things very quickly, and that's problematic. When we were having the conversation here at the church, some of the older members would say of the younger members that they're just aping contemporary culture. It's just a woke view. And I had to remind the whole church that as a 59-year-old, I was growing up being formed by the 70s, by watching TV programs which were, it was a fundamental racism or homophobia to the characters and everything like this. And almost we can think that we're a cultural blank page and we see the problem in the other, whereas all of us are shaped by the cultures in which we grew up. We can't do much about that, but I think it's important to recognise and acknowledge that and how that affects and influences us on this issue and many others.
And I think, just to stick on the end of that, that actually you've got that great statement on your website and, Trump voters are welcome here, et cetera, et cetera. or perhaps not that far, I don't know. But that's the challenge actually now to traditionalists like myself who support, and Mark actually, who support the historic definition of marriage. How do we really welcome people who are different to us? Because I think it'd be the easiest thing for me to stick a statement out there and say we welcome everybody. But that, that might not be the case. And I think lots of traditional churches think they're welcoming, but they're welcoming us to people who are like us. And once they're not like us, we'd really rather they went somewhere else. That is a huge challenge and a gospel requirement, which I think is more important to me than my view on same sex, is how do I show love to people who are radically different to myself, to people in my church? And that's not an easy one.
And just lastly then, because we're kind of running out of time, but I wondered, what did you think to the idea that something about the way the Baptists have gone about this conversation is something to offer to other churches, other denominations who are wrestling with exactly the same thing? Do you think there is something of use, something that's been helpful, that's been positive about how Baptists are engaged in this dialogue that maybe denominations watching from the outside could learn a thing or two, could pick up ideas?
Mark was right to cite our ecclesiology, because obviously basically there's three types. You've got your Episcopal, bishop, top-down kind of model. All of these, by the way, have biblical warrant, but anyway, there's that method. There's your kind of Presbyterian, which is basically the new churches. They're kind of run by boards, committees, a group of people in the church. And then there's this weird congregationalism that we're part of, which, you know, no one started a church now would ever do it this way, it appears. But we were born out of the radical changes of the Protestant era and the growing democracy movement in Europe at the time. So we do it in a very bottom-up kind of way. And if anything that we can offer, it's some ability to facilitate a conversation amongst all people and recognising the validity of the contributions of all people. Perhaps that might be something that we could offer to others.
I mean, I think possibly. I too believe in the pushing the decision making out to churches. That's fundamental to being a Baptist. I certainly, you know, I think that that's an important idea that I think other denominations may be able to learn from. But the thing that struck me about this process is the real insistence from bottom up, particularly from top down, actually, to make sure that we look after people different to us. And I think, I hope that's happening. It's happening in the few people that I know, the few Baptist ministers that I know. Reach out to people who don't believe what you believe. Reach out to people who have been hurt, who've been waiting for this day for years. They were one of the 72 people who signed that declaration, and they've been waiting for this day, and they are immensely disappointed. And that message has come out really clearly, and that's something that I think we could all learn from.
Any final thoughts, Mark?
I think that the key is, as Ashley was saying, consultation and this idea of buy-in from the maximum possible number of people. Everybody needs to feel that they're heard. But I think the other thing, and I do think this is a strength of the Baptist movement, really, is that we're not all expected to feel the same or to think the same or to act the same. I go to the Methodist conference every year as part of my work, and I think I mentioned before that you know, the Methodist conference says something and then all other congregations have to fall in line with that because they accept the authority of the conference. Well, you know, it doesn't work like that with us. And so I think there is a liberty of practice in the Baptist movement, which I think is actually very valuable. And it's messy. There's no doubt that it's messy. And I think, you know, probably all of us feel that sometimes. But I do, on the whole, think that that is a strength.
Excellent. All right. Well, that's a good place to land. Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Ashley. It's been really interesting listening, eavesdropping in your conversation. And thank you, everyone else, for listening at home as well. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye. That's it for this week's Premier Christian Newscast. But before you go, please do leave us a review on your podcast app of choice. And why not tell a friend about the show too? And if you'd like even more church news analysis, you can also subscribe to my new free email newsletter, The Critical Friend. Each week, I send an email packed with links to interesting things happening in the church world and my commentary on them. Just visit tswyatt.substack.com. to find out more and subscribe. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Premier Christian Newscast.